100,000, then 250,000, then 125,000. The figure gradually settled at between 70,000 and 80,000, the same number as made up the departed BEF. The story spread entirely by word of mouth. Owing to the official censorship, nothing appeared in the papers except in the United States. Here, the reports of homecoming Americans, most of whom had embarked at Liverpool, which was in a fury of excitement over the Russians, preserved the phenomenon for posterity. Other neutrals picked up the news. Dispatches from Amsterdam reported a large force of Russians being rushed to Paris to aid in its defence. In Paris, people hung about the railway stations, hoping to see the arrival of the Cossacks. Passing to the continent, the phantoms became a military factor, for the Germans too heard the rumours. Worry about a possible 70,000 Russians at their backs was to be as real a factor at the Marne as the absence of the 70,000 men they'd transferred to the Eastern Front. It was only after the Marne, on September 15, that an official denial of the rumour appeared in the English press. On the same Sunday as the Amiens dispatch appalled the public, Sir John French composed a report that was an even greater shock to Lord Kitchener. GHQ was then at Compiègne, 40 miles north of Paris, and the British troops, relieved of pursuit the previous day, had rested while the enemy was engaged by the French. The operation order to the BEF that day, bearing Sir John French's signature, stated that enemy pressure was relieved by a French advance in force on our right, which met with great success in the neighbourhood of Guise, where the German Guard and 10th Corps were driven back into the Oise. This ready acknowledgement of the facts, being totally irreconcilable with what Sir John then wrote to Kitchener, it can only be supposed that he signed it without reading it. He informed Kitchener of Joffre's request to him to hold fast north of Compiègne, keeping in contact with the enemy, but claimed he was absolutely unable to remain in the front line and intended to retire behind the Seine, keeping at a considerable distance from the enemy. His retirement would involve an 8-day march without fatiguing the troops and passing west of Paris so as to be near to his base. "I do not like General Joffre's plan," Sir John continued, "and would have preferred a vigorous offensive," a preference he had just refused to exercise at Saint-Quentin when he forbade Haig to cooperate with Lanrezac in the battle. Quickly reversing himself in the next sentence, Sir John made it clear that after 10 days of campaign, he was ready to give the French up as beaten and come home. His confidence in the ability of the French to carry the campaign to a successful conclusion is fast waning, he wrote, and this is my real reason for moving the British forces so far back. Although pressed very hard to remain in the front line, even in my shattered condition, he had absolutely refused to do so in accordance with the letter and spirit of Kitchener's instructions, and insisted upon retaining independence of action to retire on my base if necessary. Kitchener read the report, received on August 31, with astonishment mounting to consternation. Sir John French's intention to withdraw from the Allied line and separate the British from the French, with its appearance of deserting them in their most desperate hour, he regarded as calamitous from the political as well as the military point of view. As a violation of the spirit of the Entente, it became a question of policy, and Kitchener asked the Prime Minister to summon the cabinet at once. Before it met, he sent off a restrained telegram to Sir John, expressing his surprise at the decision to retire behind the Seine, and delicately phrasing his dismay in the form of a question. "What will be the effect of this course upon your relations with the French army and on the general military situation? Will your retirement leave a gap in the French line, or cause them discouragement of which the Germans could take advantage?" He closed with a reminder that the 32 troop trains moving through Berlin showed that the Germans were withdrawing forces from the Western Front. When Kitchener, after reading Sir John's letter to the cabinet, explained that retirement behind the Seine might mean loss of the war, the cabinet was, as Mr. Asquith put it in his muffled way, perturbed. Kitchener was authorised to inform Sir John of the government's anxiety at his proposed retirement and its expectation that you will, as far as possible, conform with the plans of General Joffre for the conduct of the campaign. "The government," he added, with care for French's amour propre, "have all possible confidence in your troops and yourself." When OHL had learned of General von Prittwitz's intention to retire behind the Vistula, he was instantly dismissed. But when Sir John French proposed to give up not a province but an ally, the same solution was not applied. The reason may have been that owing to the ravages left by the Ulster quarrel, there was no replacement upon whom government and army could agree. The government may have regarded dismissal of the commander-in-chief at such a moment as too great a shock for the public. In any event, inspired by Sir John's aura of irritability, everyone, French as well as British, continued to treat him with the utmost tact, while in fact retaining very little confidence in him. "Joffre and he have never yet been within a mile of the heart of each other," wrote Sir William Robertson, the British Quartermaster General, to the King's secretary a year later. "He has never really, sincerely and honestly concerted with the French, and they consider him as by no means a man of ability or a faithful friend, and therefore do not confide in him." This was not a situation propitious for the Allied war effort. Kitchener, whose relations with Sir John had not been cordial since the Boer War, never regained confidence in him after August 31. But it was not until December 1915 that Sir John's own machinations against Kitchener, conducted in a manner, as Lord Birkenhead was to say, neither decorous, fastidious, nor loyal, finally nerved the British government to remove him. While in London, Kitchener was waiting impatiently for Sir John's reply, Joffre, in Paris, was mobilizing the aid of the French government to try to keep the British in the front line. Joffre had by now discovered that at least half of Lanrezac's battle, the half at Guise, had been a success. Reports showing that the German Guard and X Corps had been severely handled and that Bülow's army was not pursuing, combined with the news of the withdrawal of German troops to the east, encouraged him. He told Poincaré the government might not have to leave after all. He now felt hopeful of checking the German advance in renewed action by the 5th and 6th armies. He sent a letter to the British commander telling him the 5th and 6th now had orders not to yield ground except under pressure. As they could not be expected to stand if there was a gap between them, he earnestly requested Field Marshal French not to withdraw, and at least to leave rear guard so as not to give the enemy the clear impression of a retreat and of a gap between the 5th and 6th armies. Asked by Joffre to exert his influence as President of France to obtain a favourable reply, Poincaré called the British ambassador, who called GHQ. But all the calls and visits of liaison officers were of no avail. "I refused," as Sir John later succinctly summarized his reply, and thereby punctured Joffre's momentary if illusory hope. Sir John's reply to his own government was awaited so anxiously by Kitchener that he had the decoders read it to him word by word as it came through late that night. "Of course," it said, "there would be a gap in the French line caused by his retirement. But if the French go on with their present tactics, which are practically to fall back right and left of me, usually without notice, and to abandon all idea of offensive operations, the consequences will be borne by them. I do not see why I should be called upon to run the risk of absolute disaster in order a second time to save them." This militant misstatement of the truth, after Joffre had just finished telling him the opposite, was the kind of thing that when his book 1914 was published, caused his countrymen to search helplessly for a polite equivalent of lie, and moved even Mr. Asquith to use the phrase, a travesty of the facts. Even given Sir John's limitations of character, the mystery remains how, with Henry Wilson on the staff, with his thorough knowledge of the French language, and his acquaintance with senior French officers, including Joffre himself, the British commander-in-chief could have arrived at the picture he did of French defeatism. When Kitchener finished reading the telegram at 1 a.m, he decided instantly there was only one thing to do, and it could not wait for daybreak. He must go to France himself. As senior field marshal, he was head of the army, and as such considered himself entitled to give orders to Sir John French on military matters, as well as on matters of policy in his capacity as war minister. Hastening to Downing Street, he conferred with Asquith and a group of ministers, among them Churchill, who ordered a fast cruiser for his conveyance to be ready within 2 hours at Dover. He telegraphed Sir John to expect him, and lest his appearance at GHQ embarrass the sensibilities of the commander-in-chief, asked him to select a place of meeting. At 2 a.m., Sir Edward Grey was startled out of his sleep by the apparition of Kitchener walking into his bedroom to say he was going to France. At 2:30, he departed by special train from Charing Cross, and by morning of September 1 was in Paris. Looking irritated, violent, his face congested, sulky and angry, Field Marshal French, accompanied by Sir Archibald Murray, arrived at the British Embassy, the meeting place he had selected. He intended it to emphasize the civilian nature of the conference, for he insisted on regarding Kitchener as political head of the army only, with no status other than that of any civilian war minister. His choler was hardly soothed to find Kitchener in uniform, which Sir John instantly took as an attempt to pull rank on him. In fact, after appearing in frock coat and silk hat on his first day at the War Office, Kitchener had discarded civilian clothes for the blue undress uniform of a field marshal. Sir John took it as a personal affront. Clothes were a matter of the greatest importance to him, and he had a tendency to use them to enhance his own dignity in ways his associates considered unorthodox. He offended King George by his habit of wearing stars in khaki and covering himself with foreign baubles. And Henry Wilson used to say of him, "He's a nice little man in his bath, but when he puts his clothes on, you can't trust him. You never know what he will wear." When the meeting at the British Embassy, in the presence of Sir Francis Bertie, Viviani, Millerand, and several officers representing Joffre, became increasingly acrimonious, Kitchener asked Sir John to retire with him to a private room. As Sir John's version of what was said there, published after Kitchener was dead, is unreliable, only the results of their conversation are known for certain. They were expressed in a telegram from Kitchener to the government, stating that French's troops are now engaged in the fighting line where they will remain conforming to the movements of the French army, which would mean retiring east, not west of Paris. In a copy sent to Sir John, Kitchener said he felt sure this represented the agreement they had come to, but in any event, please consider it an instruction. By in the fighting line, he said he meant disposing the British troops in contact with the French. In a fatal return to tact, he added, "Of course you will judge as regards their position in this respect." Unmollified, the commander-in-chief retired, in a sulk now deeper and more paralysing than before. During this and the previous day, Kluck's army, advancing by forced marches in its haste to envelop the French before they could take a firm stand, had overtaken Compiègne, crossed the Oise, pushing the Allied retreat before it, and on September 1 was in action against the rearguards of the French 6th Army and the BEF, 30 miles from Paris. In preparation for the greatest moment in Teutonic history, the Germans, with admirable efficiency, had already struck off and distributed to staff officers for ultimate presentation to the troops a bronze medal, confidently inscribed "Einzug des deutschen Truppen in Paris, entry of German troops into Paris." Beneath appeared the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, and, combining proud memory and anticipation, the dates 1871 to 1914. Chapter 21. Von Kluck's Turn. "An automobile drove up," wrote Monsieur Albert Fabre, whose villa at Lassigny, 12 miles north of Compiègne, was commandeered by the Germans on August 30. From it descended an officer of arrogant and impressive bearing. He stalked forward alone while the officers standing in groups in front of the villa made way for him. He was tall and majestic, with a scarred, clean-shaven face, hard features and a frightening glance. In his right hand he carried a soldier's rifle, and his left rested on the butt of a revolver. He turned around several times, striking the ground with the butt end of his rifle, and then halted in a theatrical pose. No one seemed to dare to approach him, and indeed he wore a terrible air. Gazing awestruck at this beweaponed apparition, Monsieur Fabre thought of Attila, and learned that his visitor was the already too famous von Kluck. General von Kluck, the last man on the right in Schlieffen's scheme, was at that moment considering a fateful decision. He felt himself close to the crisis on August 30. His troops on the far right had driven back units of Monory's army with success that Kluck thought was definitive. His pursuit in the centre had not succeeded in catching up with the British, but the jettisoned piles of coats, boots and ammunition found along the roadside, which the British had dumped in their anxiety to bring away their men, confirmed Cook's opinion of a beaten opponent. On his left, a division which he had lent to Bülow to help at the Battle of Guise reported the French fleeing from that battle. Cook was fiercely determined to allow them no time to recover. Reports of the direction of Lohrzac's retreat indicated that the French line did not extend as far west as had been expected. Cook believed it could be rolled up north of Paris, making a wide sweep to the west and south of the city unnecessary. The change involved a shift in the direction of his advance from due south to southeast, and would have the added advantage of closing the gap between his army and Bülow's. Like everyone else, he had begun the campaign assuming that reinforcements would be forthcoming from the left wing. He needed them now to replace the corps he had had to leave in front of Antwerp, the brigade in Brussels, the various units left to guard his ever-lengthening line of communications, not to mention his losses in combat. But reinforcements were not forthcoming. Moltke still had detached none from the left wing. Moltke had many worries. True to his temperament, gloomy Julius was less elated by the advance of his conquering armies than depressed by the difficulties of the advance. It was now the 30th day, and the schedule called for victory over France between the 36th and 40th days. Although his right-wing commanders continued to report the French and English as decisively beaten and their retreat in terms of rout and flight, Moltke was uneasy. He noticed a suspicious lack of the usual signs of rout or disorganized retreat. Why were there so few prisoners? "A victory on the battlefield is of little account," his old chief Schlieffen used to say, "if it has not resulted either in breakthrough or encirclement. Though pushed back, the enemy will appear again on different ground to renew the resistance he momentarily gave up. The campaign will go on." Despite his concern, Moltke did not go forward to investigate for himself, but remained fretting at headquarters, depending on delegates for reports. "It is heartbreaking," he wrote to his wife on August 29, "how little suspicion de Hoheer, the Kaiser, has of the seriousness of the situation. He has already a certain shout-hurrah mood that I hate like death." On August 30, as the German armies approached the climax of their campaign, OHL moved forward from Koblenz to Luxembourg City, 10 miles behind the borders of France. They were now in territory emotionally, if not officially, hostile, and which, by reason both of proximity and sentiment, was a hub of Allied rumours. Whispers circulated of the 80,000 Russians coming to help the British and French. OHL was kept busy piecing together indications of a landing somewhere on the Channel coast. The actual landing of 3,000 British Marines at Ostend, which by the time the news reached Luxembourg had swollen to serious and even Russian proportions, added apparent reality to German fears. Besides the spectre of Russians at his back, Moltke was bothered by the gaps in his battle line, especially between the armies of the right wing. There was one of 20 miles between Cook and Bülow, another of 20 miles between Bülow and Hausen, and a third almost as wide between Hausen and the Duke of Württemberg. Moltke was uncomfortably conscious that the thinning spaces should have been filled by reinforcements drawn from the left wing, which he had now committed to total involvement in the battle for the Moselle. He thought guiltily of Schlieffen's insistence that the proper course was to leave the left wing on the defensive with minimum forces and send every division that could be spared to the First and Second Armies. But the vision of a breakthrough of the French fortress line still lured OHL. Vacillating, Moltke, on August 30, sent his artillery expert, Major Bauer, to make a personal survey of Ruprecht's front. At Ruprecht's headquarters, Bauer found everything but concerted plans, and when he drove to the front lines, commanders and officers gave him conflicting opinions. Some, pointing to the unmistakable withdrawal of enemy divisions from their front, were confident of imminent success. Others complained of the difficult wooded mountains along the Moselle south of Toul, where the attack was running into trouble. Even if it succeeded, the troops would be open to flank attack from Toul, and supply lines would be lacking, since all roads and railroads led through the fortified city. Toul would have to be taken first. Back at 6th Army headquarters, the once aggressive enthusiasm of Prince Ruprecht had cooled to recognition that he was engaged in a difficult and unpleasant task. To Bauer, representing the Supreme Command, the report of French withdrawals from this front was a bad sign, for it meant that the enemy was withdrawing units to reinforce his front opposite the German right wing. He returned to OHL with the conclusion, as he told Moltke, that while the attack on Nancy-Toul and the Moselle line was not without chances, it required an extended effort that seemed not justifiable at this time. Moltke agreed, and did nothing. He could not nerve himself to call off the offensive that had already cost so much. And the Kaiser wanted to ride in triumph through Nancy. No changed orders to the Sixth Army went out. Full-scale effort to break the Moselle line continued. Von Kluck resented the failure to reinforce the marching wing at this critical time. But it was not so much the need to narrow his front as the belief that the French were already beaten and needed only to be rounded up that decided him to make an inward wheel. Instead of brushing the channel with his sleeve, he would brush Paris on the inside in direct pursuit of Lanrezac's army. That in the process he would be exposing his flank to attack by the garrison of Paris, or by Monory's forces falling back upon Paris in front of him, was a danger he did not ignore but did not estimate highly. He considered the forces so far assembled under Monory as negligible. The possibility of their being reinforced he considered also negligible, because the French, stumbling backward in the throes of defeat and disaster, must be too disorganized for such a maneuver. Moreover, he assumed that all their available forces were pinned down under the heavy pressure of the Crown Prince's army around Verdun and of Ruprecht's armies along the Moselle. One of his own corps, the laggard 4th Reserve, would be enough to leave in front of Paris to guard the flank of his army as it slid across to the east in front of the capital. After all, it had been proved in German war games that garrison forces inside an entrenched camp do not venture out until attacked. And the 4th Reserve, he believed, could contain the tatterdemalion collection of units under Monory. Having learned from a captured letter of Sir John French's intention to quit the line and retreat behind the Seine, he regarded the BEF, his direct opponent up to now, as of no further account. Under the German system, in contrast to the French, Kluck, as commander in the field, was allowed the widest possible latitude for independent decision. Prepared by indoctrination, map exercises and war games to find the correct solution of a given military problem, a German general was expected automatically to reach it when required. Through a deviation from the original strategy, Kluck's plan to ignore Paris and go after the retreating armies was the correct solution, now that it appeared to him possible to annihilate the French armies in the field without enveloping Paris. According to German military theory, a fortified camp should not be attacked until the enemy's mobile forces were overwhelmed. These once destroyed, all the other fruits of victory followed. Although the lure of Paris was strong, Kluck determined not to be tempted from the path of proper military procedure. At 6:30 on the evening of August 30, a message reached him from von Bülow that made up his mind. It requested him to make the inward wheel in order to help Bülow gain the full advantage of victory over the French Fifth Army. Whether Bülow was in fact asking for help to exploit a victory gained at Saint-Quentin, or to compensate for a defeat suffered at Guise, is, whatever the words he used, uncertain. His request fitted in with what Kluck wanted to do in any event, and Kluck made his decision. The objectives he gave for the next day's march were no longer due south, but southeast toward Noyon and Compiègne, in order to cut off the retreat of the French Fifth Army. To already protesting and footsore troops, who had not rested since they'd begun the advance at Liège 16 days before, his order of August 31 read, "Again, therefore, we must call upon the troops for forced marches." OHL, informed that the First Army would begin an inward wheel next morning, hurriedly approved. Unhappy about the gaps, Moltke saw a danger of the three armies of the right wing being unable to support each other in delivery of the final blow. Numbers had fallen below the prescribed density for an offensive, and if Kluck were to adhere to the original plan of a sweep around Paris, the front would be stretched out for another 50 miles or more. Seizing upon Cook's move as a fortunate solution, Moltke telegraphed his approval the same night. The end was in sight. The scheduled defeat of France by the 39th day, in time to turn against Russia. The proof of all German training, planning and organization. The halfway step to winning the war and mastery of Europe. It remained only to round up the retreating French before they could regain cohesion and renew resistance. Nothing, not the gaps, nor the check to Bülow's army at Guise, nor the fatigue of the men, nor any last-minute faltering or error, must be allowed to check the last dash to victory. With fierce urgency, Cook drove his army forward. As officers rode up and down the roads and sergeants rasped commands, the war-stained troops wearily formed columns on the morning of August 31 to begin another day of endless foot-slogging. Knowing nothing of maps or place names, they were unaware of the change of direction. The magic word Paris drew them on. They were not told that it was no longer their destination. Hunger added to their misery. They'd outrun their supply lines, which were functioning inadequately owing to the destruction of bridges and railroad tunnels in Belgium. Repairs had not succeeded in keeping railroads up with the advance of the armies. The focal bridge at Namur, for one, was not repaired until September 30. Often the tired infantry, after a long day's march, found the villages where they expected to billet occupied by their own cavalry. The cavalry, who were supposed to live off the country, were always so anxious about their supply trains and horses' fodder that to secure these they constantly installed themselves, according to the Crown Prince, a former cavalryman himself, in places meant for the infantry. In a piece of unexpected testimony coming from this source, he added, "They always halted and got in the way of the infantry the moment things in front began to look ugly." Cook's army met an ugly surprise on September 1 when it ran into the heels of the British, who, unaccountably, since Cook's communique said they were retreating in the most complete disorder, were able to turn upon the Germans and offer sharp and punishing combat. In a day of desperate fighting, in and around the forests of Compiègne and Villers-Cotterêts, the British rearguards held off the enemy while the main body of the BEF, to Cook's disgust, again got away. Postponing a much-needed rest for his troops, Cook ordered a further march next day, shifting back slightly to the west in the hope of enveloping the British. Again they succeeded in escaping him, just in time to get across the Marne on September 3. His chance of finishing them off was now gone. Having lost time, increased his casualties, and added marching distance, he resumed in no good temper his inward wheel in pursuit of the French. "Our men are done up," wrote a German officer of Cook's army in his diary of September 2. "They stagger forwards, their faces coated with dust, their uniform in rags. They look like living scarecrows." After 4 days of marching an average of 24 miles a day, over roads pitted with shell holes and barred by felled trees, they march with eyes closed, singing in chorus so as not to fall asleep. Only the certainty of early victory and a triumphal entry into Paris keeps them going. Without this, they would fall exhausted and go to sleep where they fall. The diary testified to a problem that was becoming increasingly serious in the German advance, especially further east, where Bülow's and Hausen's troops were coming through Champagne. "They drink to excess, but this drunkenness keeps them going. Today, after inspection, the general was furious. He wanted to stop this general drunkenness, but we managed to dissuade him from giving severe orders. If we used too much severity, the army would not march. Abnormal stimulants are necessary to combat abnormal fatigue." "We will put all that right in Paris," the officer concluded hopefully, he too evidently unaware of the new direction of the march. Through France, as through Belgium, the Germans left a blackened and defiled path as they passed. Villages were burned, civilians shot, homes looted and torn, horses ridden through rooms, artillery wagons dragged across gardens, latrines dug in the family burial plot of the Poincarés at Nubécourt. Cluck's Second Corps, passing through Senlis, 25 miles from Paris on September 2, shot the mayor and 6 other civilian hostages. A stone marker just outside the town, on the edge of a field where they're buried, bears their names. Eugène Audin, mayor, Émile Aubert, tanner, Jean Barbier, carter, Lucien Cotreau, Café waiter. Pierre Devert, chauffeur. J.B. Élisée Pommier, baker's helper. Arthur Régan, stonecutter. September 2 was a happy day for General von Hausen, who found himself billeted in the chateau of the Comte de Chabrillon at Thuny on the Aisne. Occupying the Countess's bedroom, the General was delighted to discover from examination of her visiting cards that she was née Comtesse de Lévis-Mirepoix in her own right, which caused him to sleep with that much extra pleasure in her bed. After dining on pheasant, obtained by his supply officers, who organized a shoot in the park of the chateau, Hausen counted the Countess's table silver and left an inventory of it with an old man in the village. That night, Moltke, who after a second look had developed qualms about the flank that Kluck's inward wheel was exposing to Paris, issued a new general order. As in the matter of the left wing, it showed his uncertain hand. It ratified Kluck's turn by ordering the 1st and 2nd armies to drive the French armies in a southeast direction away from Paris. At the same time, it attempted to guard against a possible danger by ordering Kluck's army to follow in echelon behind the 2nd army and make itself responsible for the flank protection of the armies. In echelon? To Kluck, the insult was worse than putting him, as OHL had done before, under Bülow's orders. The grim-visaged Attila, with rifle in one hand and revolver in the other, the pace-setter of the right wing, was not going to stay behind anybody. He issued his own orders to the 1st Army to continue its advance over the Marne tomorrow, September 3, in order to drive the French southeastward. He considered it sufficient, for purposes of protecting the flank exposed to Paris, to leave behind him his two weakest units, the 4th Reserve, which was minus a brigade left back at Brussels, and the 4th Cavalry Division, which had suffered heavily in the fight against the British on September 1. Captain Lepic, an officer of Sordet's Cavalry Corps, was reconnoitering northwest of Compiègne on August 31, the first morning of Kluck's turn, when he saw at a little distance an enemy cavalry column of 9 squadrons, followed 15 minutes later by an infantry column with batteries, ammunition wagons, and a company of cyclists. He noticed they were taking the road for Compiègne rather than the direct southward road for Paris. Unaware that he was the earliest witness of a historic swerve, Captain Lepic was more interested to report that the Uhlans had discarded their distinctive helmets and were wearing cloth caps, and that they asked directions of the local people in bad French, saying, "English, English." His information about their line of march did not as yet convey any great significance to GQG. The town and chateau of Compiègne, it was thought, might be attracting the Germans, and they could still take the road from Compiègne to Paris. Nor was Captain Lepic's view of two columns necessarily indicative of Kluck's whole army. The French, too, on August 31, knew the campaign was coming to a climax. Their second plan, the plan of August 25 to shift to the centre of gravity over to the left, in an effort to halt the German right wing, had failed. The mission of the 6th Army, which together with the British and the 5th Army was to have made a stand on the Somme, had failed. Now the mission of the 6th Army, Joffre acknowledged, was to cover Paris. The British, as he said privately, ne veulent pas marcher, they don't want to march, and the 5th Army, with Kluck in pursuit on its flank, was still in danger of being enveloped. Indeed, alarming news was brought that a spearhead of Kluck's cavalry had already penetrated between the 5th Army and Paris into the space left open by the British retreat. Clearly, as Colonel Pont, Joffre's chief of operations, told him, it seems no longer possible to oppose the right wing with sufficient forces to arrest its enveloping movement. A new plan was necessary. Survival was the immediate aim. At GQG, Joffre, with his two deputies, Bellin and Berthelot, and the senior officers of the Operations Bureau, discussed what was to be done. Into the chapel of the offensive, the hot wind of events had forced a new idea, to hold out until the French armies could stabilize a line from which to resume the offensive. Meanwhile, it was recognized the German advance would extend its forces along a tremendous arc from Verdun to Paris. The plan this time, rather than to oppose the marching wing of the German army, would be to cut it off by an attack upon the German centre, reverting to the strategy of Plan 17. Only now the battlefield was in the heart of France. A French defeat this time would not be a reverse, as at the frontiers, but final. The question was, how soon should the forward movement be resumed? At the earliest moment, on a level with Paris in the valley of the Marne? Or should the retreat continue to a line 40 miles farther back behind the Seine? Continuing the retreat meant yielding that much more territory to the Germans, but the barrier of the Seine would provide a breathing spell for the armies to gather strength when not under direct pressure of the enemy. As the Germans' chief aim was to destroy the French armies, so our chief aim, Belin urged, must be to keep ourselves alive. To take the prudent attitude and reform behind the Seine was now both a national duty and the course best designed to frustrate the aims of the enemy. So Belin argued, eloquently supported by Berthelot. Joffre listened, and next day issued General Order No. 4. It was September 1, eve of the anniversary of Sedan, and the outlook for France appeared as tragic as it had then. Official confirmation of the Russian defeat at Tannenberg came in from the French military attaché. General Order No. 4, in contrast to the firm tone of the order that followed the debacle on the frontiers, reflected the shaken optimism of GQG after a week of spreading invasion. It prescribed continued retreat for the 3rd, 4th and 5th armies for some time to come, and set the Seine and Aube as the limit of the movement, without necessarily implying that this limit will be reached. As soon as the 5th Army has escaped the menace of envelopment, the armies will resume the offensive. But unlike the previous order, it named no specific time or place. Yet it contained the genesis of the future battle, for it spoke of bringing reinforcements from the armies of Nancy and Epinal to participate in the renewed offensive, and said, "The mobile troops of the fortified camp of Paris may also take part in the general action." Upon this, as upon every other act and order of the next 4 days, layers of dispute were to be heaped by the partisans of Joffre and those of Gallieni in a long and painful controversy over the origins of the Battle of the Marne. Unquestionably, Joffre had in mind a general battle, if not the battle at the time and place it was actually to occur. The battle that he envisaged would take place when the 5 pursuing German armies would come between the horns of Paris and Verdun, and the French armies would be drawn up in a shallow curve or net stretched across the centre of France. Joffre thought he had a week's time to make his arrangements, for he told Messimy, who came to say goodbye to him on September 1, that he expected to resume the offensive on September 8, and anticipated that it would be called the Battle of Brienne-le-Château. A town 25 miles behind the Marne, about halfway between that river and the Seine, Brienne had been the scene of a Napoleonic victory over Blücher. It may have seemed an appropriate omen to Joffre. Amid the general gloom of further enforced retreat, under the awful shadow of the approaching enemy, his sang-froid, his appearance of serenity and confidence, once again impressed Messimy. It did not comfort Paris, which saw itself uncovered by a retreat of the armies to the Seine. Joffre called Millerand and gave him an unsparing summary of the military situation. The accentuated retreat of the English had uncovered the left flank of Lanrezac's army, so that the retreat must continue until Lanrezac was disengaged. Manoury had been ordered to fall back on Paris and place himself in relation to Gallieni, although Joffre said nothing about putting the 6th Army under Gallieni's command. Enemy columns were taking a direction slightly away from Paris, which might offer some respite. Nevertheless, he considered it urgent and essential that the government quit Paris without delay, either this evening or tomorrow. Gallieni, informed of this development by a frantic government, called Joffre, who managed to avoid speaking to him, but was given his message. "We are in no condition to resist. General Joffre must understand that if Manoury cannot hold, Paris cannot withstand the enemy. 3 active corps must be added to the forces of the fortified camp." Later that afternoon, Joffre called back and informed Gallieni that he was putting Manoury's army under his orders. They would now become the mobile troops of the fortified camp of Paris. Such troops are traditionally commanded independently of the field army and could be withheld from a general battle at the will of the garrison commander. Joffre had no intention of giving them up. In a deft manoeuvre on the same day, he requested the Minister of War to put the fortified camp of Paris and all its forces under his authority as commander-in-chief, to enable me to use the mobile forces of the garrison in the field if the case arises. Millerand, no less under Joffre's spell than Messimy, so ordered it on September 2. Meanwhile, Gallieni had an army at last. Manoury's forces, which he could now dispose of, consisted of one active division belonging to the 7th Corps, a native Moroccan brigade, and four reserve divisions. The 61st and 62nd, under General Ebener, which had been taken from Paris originally, and the 55th and 56th reserves, which had fought so valiantly in Lorraine. Joffre agreed to add, since it was not under his control anyway, the first-rate 45th Division of Zouaves from Algiers, which was just then detraining in Paris, and one active corps from the field army. Like Kluck, he picked a damaged one, the 4th Corps of the 3rd Army, which had suffered disastrous losses in the Ardennes. It was receiving replacements, however, and its transfer from the 3rd Army's front at Verdun to the Paris front was a reinforcement of which Kluck thought the French incapable. Troops of the 4th Corps, Gallieni was informed, would arrive by train in Paris on September 3 and 4. Instantly upon receiving Joffre's verbal assignment to him of the 6th Army, Gallieni drove north to make contact with his new command. How late was the hour was apparent when he passed refugees converging upon Paris in flight from the oncoming Germans, a look on their faces of terror and despair. At Pontoise, just outside Paris to the northwest, where the 61st and 62nd divisions were coming in, all was disorder and dismay. The troops who had been caught in severe combat as they retreated were wearied and bloody. The local population was in panic at the sound of the guns and at reports of Uhlans in the neighbourhood. After talking to General Ebener, Gallieni went on to see Manoury at Cray on the Oise, 30 miles north of Paris. He gave Manoury orders to blow up the Oise bridges and to try to delay the enemy's advance as he fell back on Paris, and under no circumstances to allow the Germans to get between him and the capital. Hurrying back to Paris, he passed a happier sight than the refugees, the splendid Zouaves of the 45th Algerian marching through the boulevards to take their places at the forts. In their bright jackets and ballooning trousers, they created a sensation and gave Parisians something to cheer once again. But inside the ministries, the mood was black. Millerand had passed on the heart-breaking facts to the president. "All our hopes are shattered. We are in full retreat all along the line. Manoury's army is falling back on Paris." As Minister of War, Millerand refused to take responsibility for the government remaining an hour longer than tomorrow evening, September 2. Poincaré faced the saddest event of my life. It was decided that the entire administration must move to Bordeaux as a unit, leaving none behind in Paris, lest the public make invidious comparisons between ministers. Upon Gallieni's return to the city that evening, he learned from Millerand that all civil and military authority for the foremost city in Europe, as it came under siege, would be left in his hands. Except for the prefect of the Seine and the prefect of police, I would be alone. The prefect of police, upon whom he would have to depend, had been in office, he discovered, barely an hour. The former prefect, Monsieur Ennion, on learning that the government was leaving, flatly refused to stay behind, and upon being ordered to remain at his post, resigned for reasons of health. For Gallieni, the exit of the government at least had the advantage of silencing the advocates of an open city. Their legal excuse was gone, and he was free to defend Paris as a fortified camp. Although he preferred to be without ministers, he thought that one or two might have stayed for the sake of appearances. This was hardly fair to those who would have liked to stay. But Gallieni's contempt for politicians was all-inclusive. Expecting the Germans at the gates in 2 days, he stayed up all night with his staff, making all my dispositions to give battle north of the city from Pontoise to the Ourcq, that is, over an area 45 miles wide. The Ourcq is a small river that feeds into the Marne east of Paris. Late that night, information reached GQG that could have spared the government the necessity of flight. During the day, a bag was brought to Captain Fagalda, intelligence officer of the Fifth Army. It had been found on the body of a German cavalry officer attached to Kluck's army, who, while riding in an automobile, had been shot and killed by a French patrol. In the bag were papers, including a map smeared with blood, which showed the lines of advance for each of Kluck's corps and the point each was to reach at the end of that day's march. The lines for the whole army pointed in a southeasterly direction from the Oise toward the Ourcq. GQG correctly interpreted Captain Fagalda's find as showing Kluck's intention to slide by Paris between the 6th and the 5th armies in an effort to roll up the left of the main French line. If they also recognized that this meant he would forego attack on Paris, they took no great pains to impress that view upon the government. When in the morning Colonel Penelon, liaison officer between GQG and the president, brought Poincaré news of Kluck's change of direction, he did not bring any suggestion from Joffre that the government need not leave. On the contrary, Joffre sent word that the government must go, that Kluck's intentions could not be certain, that his columns were already at Senlis and Chantilly, 20 miles away, and Paris would be under his guns very soon. How far the significance of Kluck's turn was understood by Poincaré or Millerand is hard to say. In the midst of war and crisis, nothing is as clear or as certain as it appears in hindsight. Urgency, even panic, was in the air. Once having gone through the agony of coming to a decision, the government found it hard to change. Millerand, in any event, continued adamant for departure. It was September 2, Sedan Day, and the hateful moment had come. When he learned that arrangements had been made for the government to leave in the middle of the night, instead of by day in the sight of the public, Poincaré's grief and humiliation increased. The cabinet insisted that his presence was legally required at the seat of government. Even Madame Poincaré, who begged to continue her hospital work in Paris as a public gesture, was not allowed to remain. Ambassador Myron Herrick of the United States, his face all puckered up, came to say goodbye with tears in his eyes. To Herrick, as to everyone inside the French capital at that moment, the terrible onslaught of the Germans, as he wrote to his son, seems almost beyond resistance. He'd received a warning from the Germans advising him to leave for the provinces, as whole quarters of Paris might be destroyed. He was determined to stay, however, and promised Poincaré to protect the museums and monuments of Paris under the American flag as being in the custody of humanity at large. Already he had formed a plan, fitting the desperate and exalted mood of the hour, that if the Germans reached the outskirts of the city and demanded its surrender, to go out and talk with their army commander and, if possible, the Kaiser. As custodian at their embassy, at their request, he could demand a hearing. In later days, when friends who had lived through the first week of September in Paris used to count themselves a select number, Gallieni would say, "Don't forget, there was also Herrick." At 7 o'clock, Gallieni went to take farewell of Millerand. The war ministry in the Rue Saint-Dominique was sad, dark, and deserted, and the courtyard filled with huge moving vans in which the archives were being piled for shipment to Bordeaux. The remainder were burned. The process of packing up created a lugubrious atmosphere. Climbing the unlit staircase, Gallieni found the minister alone in an empty room. Now that the government was leaving, Millerand did not hesitate to allow Paris and everyone in it to come under fire. His orders to Gallieni, who hardly needed to be told, were to defend Paris à outrance. "Do you understand, Monsieur le Ministre, the significance of the words à outrance?" Gallieni asked. "They mean destruction, ruins, dynamiting bridges in the center of the city." "À outrance," Millerand repeated. Saying goodbye, he looked at Gallieni as a man he was unlikely ever to see again, and Gallieni felt pretty well persuaded myself that I was remaining to be killed. Some hours later, in darkness and self-imposed secrecy that afflicted many of them with a sense of shame, ministers and members of Parliament boarded the train for Bordeaux, clothing the inglorious moment in a noble statement to the public next morning. "To hold out and fight," it said, must now become the order of the day. France would hold out and fight, While on the seas, England cut the enemy's communications with the rest of the world, and the Russians continued to advance and carried the decisive blow to the heart of the German Empire. It was not considered the moment to add news of a Russian defeat. In order to give the greatest élan and effectiveness to French resistance, the government, at the demand of the military, was moving momentarily to a place where it could remain in unbroken and constant contact with the whole country. "Frenchmen, let us be worthy of these tragic circumstances. We will obtain the final victory. By unfaltering will, by endurance, by tenacity, by refusing to perish." Gallieni was content with a short, sharp notice, worded deliberately to dispel rumours that Paris had been declared an open city, and to let the people know what to expect. His proclamation appeared on the walls of Paris in the morning. "Army of Paris, citizens of Paris, the members of the government of the Republic have left Paris to give a new impulse to the national defence. I have received a mandate to defend Paris against the invader. This mandate I shall carry out to the end. Paris, September 3, 1914. Military Governor of Paris, Commander of the Army of Paris, Gallieni." The shock to the public was all the greater, since GQG's policy of issuing only the least explicit communiques had left people uninformed as to the seriousness of the military situation. The government appeared to have decamped without due cause. Its nocturnal going off left a painful impression, which was not dispelled by what proved to be an extended and tenacious affection for Bordeaux. Puns were made at the expense of the government, calling them tornados à la Bordelaise, and the crowds who stormed the railway stations in their wake inspired a parody of the Marseillaise. "Au gars, citoyens, montez dans les wagons." These were days of anguish for the military government of Paris. With the armies retreating north and east of the city, the problem of how long to hold and when to destroy the 80 bridges in the region caused increasing tension and anxiety. Commanders in each sector, as soon as they had assured passage of their own troops, were anxious to blow up the bridges behind them in order to cut off pursuit. GQG's orders were to let no bridge fall intact into enemy hands. At the same time, the bridges would be needed for a return to the offensive. Three different commands were operating in the area: Gallieni's, Joffre's, and geographically between them that of Sir John French, whose chief concern since Kitchener's visit was to make a show of his independence of everybody. Engineers of the Paris camp guarding the bridges were beset by a conflict of orders. "A disaster is preparing," reported an officer of engineers to General Hirschauer. By nightfall of September 2, the British had reached the Marne and got across next day. Below Compiègne, the troops discovered they were marching off their maps. And now it dawned on them that this was not, after all, a strategic retreat, as they'd been told by their officers. Their bases at Boulogne and Havre had by now been evacuated, and all stores and personnel moved down to Saint-Nazaire, at the mouth of the Loire. About a day's march behind them, the Fifth Army was still not yet out of danger of envelopment. In the continuing hot weather, retreat and pursuit went on, prey as tired as pursuers. Since the Battle of Guise, the Fifth Army had been marching 18 to 20 miles a day. Along its route, groups of deserters pillaged farms and homes and spread panic among the population with tales of German terror. Executions took place. Lohazac thought no army ever underwent such an ordeal as his. At the same time, a British officer said of the BEF, "I would never have believed that Ben could be so tired and so hungry and yet live." Trying to find a source of encouragement during these days, Henry Wilson said to Colonel Huguet, "The Germans are ever hasty. They urge the pursuit too fast. The whole thing is overdone. They're bound to make a big mistake, and then your hour will come." Up to this point, Joffre and his advisers at GQG, although aware of Kluck's inward wheel, did not see in it an important or early opportunity for attack on his flank. Kluck's shift in pursuit of the British on September 2 left them uncertain whether he might not be turning back against Paris. In any event, their minds were not on Paris, but were fixed on a general battle along the Seine, not to take place until they had re-established a solid front. After further anxious consultation at GQG, Joffre came to a decision to continue the retreat, several days' march to the rear of where the armies then stood, which would allow time to bring up reinforcements from his right wing. Despite the risk of weakening the barely held line of the Moselle, he decided to bring over a corps each from the 1st and 2nd armies. His decision was embodied in secret instructions issued to the army commanders on September 2, which made the Seine and Aube definitive as the line to be reached. The object, Joffre explained, was to extricate the armies from the enemy's pressure and enable them to reorganize. And when this had been accomplished and reinforcements from the east brought up, at that moment to pass to the offensive. The British army would be asked to participate in the manoeuvre, and the garrison of Paris will act in the direction of Meaux, that is, against Kluck's flank. Still omitting a date, Joffre said he would give the signal within a few days. Commanders were ordered to take the most draconian measures against deserters to ensure orderly retreat. Asking each to understand the situation and extend his utmost efforts, Joffre made it clear that this would be the battle upon which the salvation of the country depends. Gallieni, receiving the orders in Paris, condemned Joffre's plan because it sacrificed Paris and was divorced from reality. He believed the pace of the German pursuit would allow the French armies no time to reach or reform upon the Seine. Scattered reports of Kluck's south-eastward march were reaching him, but he had not been informed of the vital confirmation found by Captain Fagalde. On the night of September 2, expecting attack next day, he slept at his headquarters, which were now established in the Lycée Victor Duruy, a girls' school across the street from the Invalides. A large building set back behind trees, it was isolated from the public, and having fewer entrances and exits than the Invalides, was easier to guard. Sentinels were posted at the doors, field telephones connected with all divisional headquarters of the fortified camp, offices set apart for the operations and intelligence staffs, mess and sleeping quarters arranged, and Gallieni was enabled with great relief to move into a regular field headquarters just as at the front. The following morning, September 3, he learned definitely of Kluck's movement toward the Marne, away from Paris. Lieutenant Watteau, an aviator of the Paris garrison making a reconnaissance flight, saw the enemy columns gliding from west to east toward the valley of the Ourcq. Later, a second airplane from the Paris camp confirmed the report. In the staff room of Gallieni's deuxième bureau, an unspoken excitement communicated itself among the officers. Colonel Giraudon, an officer wounded at the front, who, however, considered himself fit to do staff work, was lying on a chaise longue with his eyes fixed on the wall map, on which coloured pins traced the direction of the German advance. General Clergery, Gallieni's chief of staff, entered the room just as another air reconnaissance report from British aviators was brought in. As once more the pins were moved, the track of Kluck's turn appeared unmistakably on the map, and Clergery and Giraudon cried out together, "They offer us their flank! They offer us their flank!" Chapter 22. Gentlemen, we will fight on the Marne. Gallieni instantly saw the opportunity offered to the army of Paris. Without hesitating, he made up his mind to launch an attack on the flank of the German right wing at the earliest moment, and induce Joffre to support the manoeuvre by resuming the offensive at once on the entire front, instead of continuing the retreat to the Seine. Although the army of Paris, of which Monoury's 6th Army was the corps, was under Gallieni's command, the camp of Paris, with all its forces, had been since the day before under Joffre's command. To launch the 6th Army upon the offensive, two conditions were necessary: Joffre's consent and support of the 6th Army's nearest neighbour, the BEF. Both stood between Paris and Kluck's flank, Monoury north and the British south of the Marne. Gallieni summoned his chief of staff, General Clergery, to what Clergery called one of those long conferences he holds on grave issues. They usually last from 2 to 5 minutes. It was now 8:30 p.m. of September 3. They agreed, if Kluck's line of march were maintained next morning, to exert every pressure upon Joffre for an immediate combined offensive. Aviators of the Paris camp were ordered to make early reconnaissance flights, upon which grave decisions would depend, and to report before 10 a.m. Success of a flank attack, as General Hirschhauer warned, depends on the spearhead penetrating. And the Sixth Army was not the strong, sharp instrument Gallieni would have liked. It had reached the positions assigned to it in a generally exhausted condition. Some units had marched 37 miles during the day and night of September 2. Fatigue depressed morale. Gallieni